Welcome back to the Paycheck Paradox. We are so glad you could tune in for what's going to be a really crucial discussion today.
It really is.
We're tackling the, I guess you could call it the elephant in the financial room right now, the one that everyone seems to have a very, very strong and usually pretty terrifying opinion about.
Artificial intelligence investing.
Exactly. AI investing. And for this conversation, we're really going to be looking at some source material you sent over, focusing on the current AI craze, the market volatility, and maybe most importantly, something that gets overlooked a lot, the psychological cost of just waiting.
Right. And our insights today, they're mostly drawn from this really illuminating article on the blog, paycheckparadox.com.
Which is, of course, also the name of this podcast.
Of course. And what the article really does is it forces you to move past that, you know, that simple binary fear of a bubble.
Yeah. Is it or isn't it?
Exactly. And instead, it helps you understand the, let's say, the nuanced life cycle of how wealth is actually generated during one of these massive technological shifts.
Yeah.
Our mission here isn't just to summarize an article.
No, not at all. We want to give you a framework, a way to think about this so you can navigate this whole environment intelligently.
We want to help you, the listener, understand what you're truly risking when you decide to just sit on the sidelines. We're aiming for insight, for a kind of structural understanding, and some actionable rules, not panic.
No more panic. And just a quick reminder for everyone listening, for every single topic we cover here on the Paycheck Paradox podcast, we also produce a full video version over on YouTube.
And that's really helpful for this topic in particular.
It is. The videos have custom visuals we put together that, you know, they really help illustrate the data, the charts, and especially the historical comparisons we're about to get into.
Yeah, when we start talking about market cycles and these divergence signals, seeing it on a chart really, really makes it click.
It really does. Now, before we unpack these concepts, and this is very important, we have to state this clearly.
Great, the mandatory disclaimer.
Mandatory disclaimer. The discussion you're about to hear is for educational and informational purposes only. We are analyzing source material to provide context.
We are not giving you investment recommendations.
Yeah.
This is not financial advice. Please, please consult a qualified professional before you make any financial decisions.
Absolutely. Okay, let's do this. We're moving straight into what the sources are calling the bubble paradox. The cost of premature fear.
I like that framing. The cost of fear.
It's a universal truth, isn't it? The favorite pastime of financial pundits, those social media gurus, and yes, that one cautious uncle you see at Thanksgiving.
I'm an uncle.
Their favorite thing to do is predict the next crash. They just love talking about bubbles. It gives them this air of wisdom, you know?
Caution. It does. It provides a sense of intellectual superiority. By warning everyone, they get to position themselves as the prudent shepherd protecting the flock from danger.
Right. They sound smart by sounding scared. And the current target, of course, is artificial intelligence. The refrain is just everywhere, and it's always the same.
It's the dot-com bust all over again.
It's 1999.
The crash is coming, and it's going to be brutal. You hear it constantly.
And here's the slightly awkward truth that the sources admit right up front. Eventually, they're probably going to be right.
They will be. Bubbles do eventually pop. That's just the nature of financial excess. It's human enthusiasm running way ahead of, you know, physical reality.
But the fact that a correction will come someday, that's not really the issue, is it?
No, that inevitability is not the issue at all. And this brings us right to the central paradox that the vast majority of investors seem to miss completely.
Which is what?
Spotting a bubble, you know, identifying a sector that's maybe overpriced, it's growing too fast, it's driven by excessive enthusiasm. That's the easy part. It's actually relatively easy.
Yeah, I mean, if a company that doesn't make any money sees its stock go up 500% in a year, you could probably guess it's a bubble. You don't need a Nobel Prize for that.
Exactly. The difficulty isn't in spotting it. The truly difficult, the almost impossible thing, is knowing the exact moment when to leave the party.
When's the peak?
When is the peak? When do you sell everything and go to cash? There's no analytical tool, no economic model, and certainly no pundit on TV that can reliably predict the day or even the quarter when that sentiment is finally going to turn for good.
You hear those stories, right? Brilliant investors who were right about the 2000 bust, but they said it in 1998.
And their funds got liquidated before 1999 was even over because they just couldn't hold out against that final surge, that melt up.
And that's the critical insight here. Refusing to even attend the party at all just because you're scared of the eventual hangover, that's a guaranteed way to miss out on what our sources call life-changing wealth.
You're sacrificing 100% of the potential upside just to avoid a downside that, look, if you manage it correctly, it shouldn't be a 100% loss anyway.
So let's bring it to today. If you are currently avoiding AI stocks purely because you're afraid of a bubble, the argument is you're not actually playing it safe.
No, you're engaging in a different and maybe far more insidious kind of risk. The risk of non-participation.
The risk of just not being there.
It's the risk of financial stagnation, right? When a monumental generational growth period is happening. And the sources argue that this risk, this non-participation risk, is far greater than the risk of volatility, especially for anyone actively trying to build significant wealth.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine the psychological damage. You look back 10 years from now and you realize, hey, I was right, the bubble did eventually pop.
But I missed a 500% gain because I was afraid of a 30% correction.
That fear, that paralysis, it's a decision.
Yeah.
And it forces you to redefine what risk truly means. Risk isn't just the tangible thing, the loss of capital.
It's also the risk of delaying your financial goals by years, maybe even decades. The risk of missing the most explosive wealth generation phase of a massive long-term technological revolution is, well, it's often completely discounted by cautious investors.
And that's the real tragedy.
It is. We are programmed as humans to avoid loss, but we're not programmed to fear missed opportunity, even though, you know, the latter is often far, far more costly.
And that ties right into compounding, doesn't it?
It's all about compounding. That missed 500% gain isn't just lost principal. It's lost compounding power that could have accelerated your wealth creation just dramatically.
So if a bubble pops, you might lose 30, maybe 40%.
But if you avoid the boom entirely, you lose the 500% that was supposed to power your future growth.
Huh.
That difference in magnitude is what makes this premature fear such a, well, a devastating financial choice.
Okay, so let's address the big comparison, the one that's in every single article about AI. The dot-com bubble.
The inevitable comparison.
Right. And our source material calls this a lazy analysis, but I want to challenge that for a second. The leading chip maker right now, its price-to-earnings ratio is significantly higher than a lot of valuations were back in late 1999.
That's a very fair point.
So doesn't that suggest the valuation is divorced from reality, even if the company's cash flow is strong? Why is the 1999 comparison considered so lazy?
That's a critical question to ask.
Yeah.
And you're right. On the surface, the valuation multiples look insane.
Yeah.
But the comparison is lazy, not because the charts don't look, you know, parabolic.
Because they do.
They absolutely do. It's lazy because it only looks at the charts and it completely ignores the underlying financial reality. The foundation of the companies involved, the fundamentals that are driving this AI rally today are just radically, fundamentally different from what was driving the 1999 bubble.
Okay, let's break that down. Let's start with the foundation of 1999. The source calls it the vaporware difference. What exactly was the market bidding up back then, and why was it all so fragile?
It was built on hope. It was built on speculative business plans and, yeah, vaporware. The market was giving these enormous valuations to businesses based purely on their potential, not their performance.
So specific examples.
Think about the classic ones, Pets.com, Webvan, and dozens of others. What characterized these businesses?
Well, they had no revenue.
Basically no revenue, and certainly no clear path to profitability. They were often involved in, like, logistics that made absolutely no economic sense.
They were literally losing money on every single sale. They were told to prioritize market share and brand recognition over actually being solvent.
Precisely. Their key metrics were based purely on eyeballs. How much traffic, how many clicks, how many visitors, rather than actual tangible cash flow. There are tiny startups burning through these vast amounts of capital.
And spending it on things like Super Bowl ads.
Exactly. Millions of dollars on a single Super Bowl ad, just to create awareness for a business that couldn't even cover its own shipping costs. It was pure speculation, totally divorced from operational solvency and free cash flow.
Okay, so now let's contrast that sharply with the current AI rally. Let's call it the infrastructure reality.
It's a completely different class of business leading the charge.
True.
We are talking about the behemoths.
Right.
These are the most well-capitalized, most profitable companies in the entire history of capitalism. Companies that, look, even if AI went cold tomorrow, they would still be generating massive profits from cloud computing, search advertising, enterprise software.
We're talking about the obvious heavyweights, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Google. Their core businesses are gigantic and stable.
And they are sitting on what the source material correctly describes as fortresses of cash.
Yeah.
You just have to look at their financials. They are printing billions in free cash flow every single quarter.
And that's crucial because it gets back to my point about the high PE ratio, right?
It is. While the ratio is high, it reflects the magnitude of the cash they can immediately deploy into this AI build-out. They're essentially fueling their own future growth without having to resort to debt or excessive dilution.
So the money flowing into the sector isn't just, you know, retail traders hoping for the next big app.
Not at all. It's driven by massive institutional capital and, more importantly, by these companies themselves deploying their own vast fortunes into infrastructure at a speed we've never seen before.
And that leads directly to this really critical distinction in the source, the shovel sellers.
Yes. These foundational AI players, they're not selling some hypothetical future app. They are selling the actual shovels for what is arguably the biggest infrastructure build-out since, I don't know, the electrification of the country in the early 20th century.
The demand is physical. It's verifiable. We're talking about specialized chips, the H100s, the A100s.
The construction of massive data centers that need unprecedented amounts of power and cooling. The foundational cloud computing resources that every single other company in the world needs to implement their own AI models.
So when you invest in a company like NVIDIA today, you're not betting on whether AI app X will beat AI app Y.
No, you're making a much more fundamental bet. You're betting that everyone, every company, every researcher, every military, every competitor is going to need exponentially more processing power for the next 5 to 10 years.
And the money is also shifting, right? From just training the models to actually using them.
That's a huge point. It's shifting from training these large models, which is a big capital expense, to inference, the actual day-to-day deployment and use of those models.
Yeah.
And inference is going to be a recurring, high-margin revenue stream for these cloud providers and chip makers for decades to come.
Okay, but we have to acknowledge the nuance here. The sources did. We know there's a speculative element out there.
Oh, absolutely. The speculative froth has not vanished. There are small, speculative AI wrapper companies.
What's a wrapper company?
It's business that basically takes a large language model from someone else, puts a slightly custom user interface on top of it, and then claims they have proprietary AI.
And those will probably go to zero.
Many of them will likely go to zero, just like so many of the dot-coms did. That segment of the market is absolutely in a speculative mania. That's where the comparison holds true.
But the key difference is that those small speculative companies are not the ones driving the major indices to new highs.
No. It's the infrastructure providers. It's the large, profitable behemoths that are dictating the overall market movement. The foundation is rock solid, even if the fringes are, you know, frothy and dangerous.
Right. If the behemoths were running out of cash like Pets.com did, we'd be running for the hills.
We would. But since the behemoths are the ones selling the shovels, we have to recognize that this rapid market move reflects enormous, verifiable fundamental demand.
And this analysis provides the perfect transition because it takes us away from that simple binary fear. Most investors, they get stuck on that tired old question, are we in a bubble?
And like we discussed, that question is just fundamentally unhelpful. It only allows for two answers, yes or no. And if your emotional answer is yes,
the automatic response is to sell everything, go to cash, and hide under the bed, missing years of potential upside.
Exactly. So if that binary question only leads to paralysis or a premature exit, what's the profitable question? What's the one we should actually be focusing on?
The right question, according to the source, is where are we in the bubble's life cycle?
We have to assume that every major technological adoption creates some kind of speculative bubble phase.
It's just the stock market's way of efficiently, if violently, pricing in a massive future reality.
But that phase isn't just a single point in time. It's a long, multi-year process.
A very long process. So let's synthesize the stages the sources mentioned. It starts with displacement.
Okay, displacement.
This is where the new technology, in this case AI, captures everyone's attention, and it fundamentally displaces the old ways of doing things. You know, the shift from human writers to generative text, for example. This phase is where the early visionary investors get in.
Yeah, and comes the boom phase. Right. The boom is where prices start moving up consistently as the early adopters begin to recognize the vast commercial potential.
And the boom phase eventually transitions into the infamous euphoria phase. This is the stage everyone warns you about, the point where the rational explanation for the price just stops making sense to traditional value investors.
Right. But, and this is the key insight from the source material, this euphoria phase, which is often called the melt-up, this is where the majority of the entire cycle's gains are actually made.
So the most dangerous-looking phase is also the most profitable.
Historically, yes. It's the most profitable period for those who participate, and it can run for months or even years. Then, of course, it's followed by profit taking, where the smart money starts to quietly distribute their shares.
And finally, panic. The crash everyone fears, driven by margin calls and liquidity just drying up.
So if you're an investor, your goal is simple. You want to be fully engaged during the boom and euphoria phases, and you need to have a mechanism, a rule, to get you out somewhere during the profit-taking stage, certainly before the full panic sets in.
The financial tragedy is trying to exit prematurely, before the melt-up even hits its stride.
Let's use that dot-com example again, but this time to illustrate the lethal cost of getting out too early during the cycle.
Okay.
If you were a cautious, prudent investor in late 1998, you would have looked at the NASDAQ valuations, even of the strong companies, and you would have correctly concluded, this is absurd, valuations are stretched.
And you would have been right about the absurdity of the valuation.
You would have been entirely correct in your assessment. But what did that prudence cost you? If you sold everything and went to cash at the end of 1998, you missed the single greatest year of returns in a generation.
Wow.
The sources remind us that the NASDAQ composite rose an astounding 85% in 1999 alone.
85%. That's a monumental, career-defining, retirement-altering amount of compounding to miss just because you were scared of a possible correction down the line.
The market didn't even tweak until March of 2000. So you would have forfeited 15 months of just massive, massive gains.
And what about the aftermath? I mean, the bubble did pop.
It did, spectacularly. But the foundational companies that survived that initial melt-up, Amazon, Cisco, Microsoft, they recovered. And they went on to far surpass their bubble highs years later. So the investor who sold in 98 to avoid the crash,
they missed the 1999 boom.
And they missed the eventual massive recovery and long-term compounding of the actual winners. It was a lose-lose decision.
So applying this to AI today, we're seeing this massive physical build-out of infrastructure. This isn't some three-month hype cycle. This takes years to execute.
Years. Building gigawatt-scale data centers, manufacturing millions of these specialized chips, routing fiber optics, integrating AI into every single enterprise software system on the planet. That takes years, not months.
So if we accept the idea that we're only in the early innings of this whole secular trend, let's say we're in the equivalent of 1996 or 1997 in the internet cycle.
Then selling now to avoid a crash that might not even happen until, let's just hypothesize, 2027 or 2028, that would be the definition of a financial tragedy.
You're sacrificing guaranteed years of parabolic growth for the comfort of avoiding a correction that you haven't even had to face yet.
The certainty of the missed opportunity outweighs the uncertainty of the future volatility. It just reframes the entire conversation away from risk aversion and toward risk management.
The goal is to maximize your time in the melt-up phase.
Exactly.
This brings us to a concept that is, I think, particularly relevant for listeners who are pursuing financial independence, or FI, we need to talk about opportunity cost.
It's far more dangerous than most people give it credit for, especially in a secular boom like this.
How so?
In the pursuit of wealth accumulation, especially for those trying to reach independence quickly, the source material argues that opportunity cost is, and I quote, just as deadly as capital loss.
That's a strong statement.
It is. Capital loss hurts immediately. You see your balance drop, it's visceral. But opportunity cost is a silent killer. It delays your goals by years, and it operates entirely in the shadows.
It's the silent erosion of your potential. You don't see the money disappearing from your account, but you watch the calendar move forward, and your retirement goal just stays stubbornly distant.
Let's make this concrete. Let's detail the financial consequence of this fear with a simple scenario of mediocrity.
Okay.
Let's assume you follow the cautious pundit's advice. You take your $100,000 portfolio and you sit on it in cash, maybe in a high-yield savings account, earning a very respectable 4% rate of return annually.
Sounds safe. Sounds good.
And after 5 years, your $100,000 has grown to roughly $121,665. Not bad.
Meanwhile, the sector that's driving the market, these infrastructure players we've been talking about, it returns 40% a year for the next 5 years. Now, that's aggressive, but it's certainly achievable during a powerful melt-up phase.
The difference is just staggering. The person who participated in that trend managing their risk along the way, they see their $100,000 portfolio balloon to approximately $537,000 after those same 5 years.
So the gap between about $122,000 and $537,000, that is the direct cost of non-participation.
It's nearly $400,000. That one fearful decision, that act of non-participation, is calculated by the sources as potentially setting your financial independence date back by a decade or more.
A decade.
You've voluntarily forfeited the primary engine of modern wealth creation, this huge gap, this financial loss of potential. That's the price of what the source calls the fear tax.
The fear tax. I like that.
It's a tax you pay voluntarily for the luxury of avoiding volatility. And the core paradox is that by trying to avoid volatility, you are guaranteeing financial mediocrity in your returns, which is the exact opposite of what you need for financial independence.
And mediocrity is lethal to the FEI timeline. You simply cannot compound your way to freedom by sitting on the sidelines during the inflation phase of a secular trend. You need that exponential growth phase to dramatically reduce your time to FA.
And we should stress the term secular trend here. This is crucial.
Yeah.
Secular trends are not temporary fads. They are fundamental shifts that last for decades.
Like the railroad boom.
The railroad boom in the 19th century. The Industrial Revolution driven by steel and oil. The electrification of the country. When the market prices in a shift of this magnitude, the boom that results isn't just speculative, it's a fundamental repricing of future global productivity.
And that is how the source material views AI, as a secular shift on the scale of the internet or electricity itself.
Exactly. And if you miss the primary growth phase of a trend like that, you miss the primary engine of modern wealth creation. You pay the fear tax in years of your life, not just dollars.
That reframing makes the risk of not investing far, far scarier than the risk of investing with appropriate caution.
It really does.
Okay, so the goal isn't to avoid the trend. The goal is to participate smartly, recognizing that the music will eventually stop.
Right.
We need a strategy that shifts from emotional avoidance to rule-based risk management. So the question is, how do we invest in this potential bubble without getting completely destroyed when the music stops?
The fundamental shift in mindset is crucial here. You have to learn to separate the narrative from the price action. The narrative is the constant fear, the bubble headlines on the news, all the emotional chatter.
And the price action.
The price action is the actual underlying demand, the CapEx cycles, the earnings growth of the company selling the infrastructure. We have to focus on rules, not on feelings.
Okay, let's get into the weeds. Let's dive into the three core rules for, as the source puts it, dancing near the exit. Rule number one, ride the inflation, but keep your parachute. And that parachute is trailing stop losses.
The philosophy here is really simple. You want to capture the immense upside, those melt-up gains, but you have to recognize that buy and hold forever is often terrible advice for speculative, rapidly moving sectors like this.
Right. For these specialized growth plays, you need an automated mechanical exit mechanism, something to neutralize your own emotion.
And that mechanism is the trailing stop loss. Let's explain how that works and the crucial percentage buffer. Why is something like 15% or 20% often cited as the sweet spot in these high volatility tech sectors?
Yeah, why not 5%?
A trailing stop loss is an instruction you give your broker to sell a position if it drops by a specific percentage from its high point. In high volatility, high growth tech stocks, the sources suggest setting that stop between 15 and 20%.
And why that range specifically?
Because it's wide enough to accommodate the normal day-to-day volatility, you know, the natural swings that can easily be 5 to 10% in a single week. But it's also tight enough to protect you against a catastrophic sentiment-driven collapse.
So if a stock is up 100% and I have a 20% trailing stop on it, my automated sell order is currently sitting at a point where I've locked in 80% of my gains.
Exactly. And as the stock rises, that floor rises with it.
That's the key.
It is. If the stock hits $100 and you have a 20% stop, your floor is $80. If that stock continues to climb to $200, your 20% stop is now sitting at $160. This is the beauty of the mechanism.
So if the bubble keeps inflating, if the melt-up continues for another 2 years,
your stop automatically rises with it, continuously locking in more and more of those gains for you.
And when the bubble does burst, or when the inevitable profit-taking hits hard, the market takes you out automatically at $160. You don't have to make a panicked, emotional decision at the bottom.
You might lose that final 15 or 20% off the very top, but you keep the substantial ride up, the 80% gain, which is a massive life-altering win. This is how sophisticated investors manage risk during the euphoria phase. You participate until the market itself forces you out.
And there's an important warning here, though, about setting that stop too tight, like at 5% or 8%.
Absolutely. The source cautions that if your stop is too tight, you become prey to what's known as shaking out the weak hands.
What does that mean?
Market makers will often briefly drive down the price of a volatile stock specifically to trigger all those tight stop loss orders. They buy up the shares cheaply, only for the price to recover the very next day. A 15 to 20% buffer gives you protection against that normal noise and that kind of targeted manipulation, while still offering robust protection against a genuine structural collapse.
Okay, that makes sense. Rule number two, watch the data, not the headlines. Where does the actual signal for the end of the party come from? Because we know we can't rely on media sentiment.
No. Bubbles burst when the underlying reality, the fundamentals, can no longer support the valuation and the market finally realizes it. So we need to focus on two specific measurable data points and just ignore all the chatter.
First, we need to watch the margins, but not of the AI companies themselves, of their customers.
Yes, this is so important. We need to look beyond the shovel sellers and assess the health of their customers. Are the big AI spenders, the enterprises pouring billions into chips and cloud subscriptions, are they seeing a clear, measurable return on investment, an ROI?
So if a bank spends $500 million on an AI implementation, is that translating into a $600 million reduction in labor costs or a significant increase in revenue through new products?
Exactly. If companies are pouring billions into AI, but their own margins start collapsing because the ROI isn't there, that suggests the fundamental use case isn't working yet. And the whole edifice is built on unsustainable spending.
That's a massive red flag for the shovel sellers.
A huge one. And the second, and maybe the most critical indicator, watch for acceleration and divergence. This is the definitive signal that a fundamental repricing has turned into a pure speculative bubble.
How do we measure that divergence in a practical way?
We compare the company's earnings growth against its stock price acceleration. Let's imagine a leading AI company reports 25% year-over-year earnings growth, and its stock price rises 30% that year.
That seems rational.
It is. It's totally rational. The market is fundamentally repricing the value of that company based on excellent performance. It's thought to burn, but it's anchored in reality.
So the moment of true danger is when the market loses the plot.
Yes. Divergence is when that company's earnings growth starts to slow down or plateau. Maybe it's only growing 5% a year. But its stock price suddenly speeds up and is accelerating 50 or 100% a year.
That means the market is driven entirely by speculation.
By speculation, by retail enthusiasm, by pure emotion, not by fundamental reality. That divergence is your unequivocal red flag. It's your signal to tighten those stops and prepare to exit because the underlying engine is failing while the hype continues.
And until that data point, that clear divergence in growth rates actually shows up, the sources suggest that the rapid price movement we're seeing is just the market recognizing and correcting the massive undervaluation that existed before the AI boom began.
The price is catching up to the future. It's not running away from reality yet.
Okay, and that brings us to rule number three, which is about practical risk control. Size your bets. This strategy is really designed to mitigate the psychological fear of participating in the first place. It allows you to stay in the game without that paralyzing fear.
Yeah, because even with trailing stops, the thought of putting your entire net worth into a volatile high-growth sector is terrifying.
And frankly, very unwise.
It's completely unnecessary, and it violates core principles of diversification. The goal is participation, not recklessness. You do not need to put 100% of your net worth into speculative small-cap AI stocks or even the big infrastructure names.
So the strategy advocated is the core and satellite portfolio.
That's it. You maintain your core portfolio, the vast majority of your wealth, maybe 80 to 95% of it, in diversified indices. Your global market funds, your S&P 500.
This is your sleep at night money.
It is. This portfolio is designed for stability, reliable dividend reinvestment, and consistent low volatility growth. Then you use a much smaller, highly aggressive satellite portfolio specifically designated for this high growth, high volatility theme like the AI infrastructure play.
And what kind of allocation are we talking about for that satellite?
Sources often suggest keeping the satellite portfolio allocation between maybe 5 and 10% of your total investable assets. This amount is specifically designed to be fun money, money you can afford to lose, but which also offers these outsized returns if the melt-up continues.
And what does that achieve, both psychologically and financially?
Psychologically, it achieves resilience, first and foremost. If that highly speculative satellite portfolio bursts, if it goes down 50% overnight, the loss hurts, but it doesn't kill you. Your core wealth is still protected and diversified.
But the upside?
The upside is huge. If that trend runs for another 3 years, that smaller satellite portfolio could still generate so much outperformance because of the intense compounding effects of the melt-up phase, that it could significantly accelerate your timeline toward financial independence.
So you capture the upside without betting the farm.
It's a calculated, manageable risk. It's designed to maximize participation while respecting the inevitability of future volatility. Mm-hmm. It separates the emotion from the allocation.
Okay, so that brings us to the summary, the bottom line of this entire analysis. We spent today moving past the panic, recognizing that the AI revolution is a fundamental fact. It's an infrastructure build-out, not just hype.
And the core philosophical takeaway is this. History is written by the victors, but wealth, true exponential wealth, is built by the participants. You cannot win a race you refuse to enter. By prioritizing non-participation out of fear, you are making a financial choice that is mathematically guaranteed to cost you.
The market rewards those who manage risk using disciplined tools like trailing stop losses and clear data points like divergence, not those who avoid risk entirely. If you avoid the trend, you guarantee financial mediocrity.
So the action plan is pretty clear. If you believe in the secular trend, invest. Set your rules, particularly your trailing stop losses. Mm. Watch the divergence in earnings and price, not the emotional headlines. And enjoy the ride while being prepared for that inevitable mechanical exit.
And the final provocative thought to leave you with is this. The greatest risk in a secular boom might not be the mechanical failure of the market itself, the inevitable crash. It might be the psychological failure to participate, driven by a premature, paralyzing fear.
Think about how many years of your life that fear tax is costing you right now. A thought certainly worth mulling over until our next session.
Thank you for tuning in to The Paycheck Paradox. Be on the lookout for the next episode where we continue our financial exploration.